Welcome to episode 17 of the Signed Radio Show. In this episode, Ferris joins us to talk about covering a wide range of platforms with a wide range of ideas. Hi, and welcome to the Signed Radio Show, episode 17. I am Zifoid.
And I'm Axel. Hello.
Hello. How is everything going?
All good so far, thanks, over there. How you busy as always, we're trying to find some time to squeeze in for these podcasts. So.
Yes, and that is also why we don't have Aki with us now, because he's on vacation when we record this, but he'll be joining for the interview with Ferris. Later on, and that's going to be an interesting one, I'm sure. I mean, Ferris is one of these guys that I'm a bit annoyed with, to be honest. Way too talented. He's young, he's beautiful, he's just an amazing dude, a really nice guy. So I'm annoyed with him in a good way, in that sense.
Yeah, it will be interesting to talk to him, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing with him is that no matter what you throw at him, he can handle it. It was like, yeah, I want to do that as well. But hey, I'm an old fart, so I can't really do that.
Deadline took place as well, right?
So yes.
After a long break of no parties, or pretty much no parties in physical forum, deadline was taking place with a lot of uproar in the beginning with the vaccination discussion. But overall, I think it benefited greatly from it, right? Or how do you say it?
Yeah, from what I saw, I've been out of the loop as well lately, but it looks like it was really a success. And the uproar before it was quite massive, to say the least. The thread on Poet went on rather harshly, but I think in the end, it all turned out really good.
Yeah, I think the overall number of productions and the people there and the feedback that they gave after the event was positive throughout, and I think some of them are still digesting that they were at the party again and actually really seeing people seeing everyone again and meeting friends and enjoying what we all enjoy at parties of this kind. So this is a really good news that Deadline was going through this process so smoothly,
and no big outbreak afterward either. So that was really good.
Yeah, let's hope it keeps that way, right? So no late stories, hopefully, from people who are having an outbreak or something. But so that's good news for parties to come, I guess. Let's hope that we can... Do you have any plans to attend any parties that are upcoming? Or
I would love to, but right now the horizon is not really shining well on that respect. I would love to go to Portugal for Inercia, but that's a bit too close. I mean, it's the end of October, so it's in next week or something.
Right, so pack your bags.
yep, just heading off. No, but I'm still hoping for a physical revision next year, even though it might not look that easy to pull that off. But hopefully there'll be other parties in the not too distant future then, because I really miss that. And I mean, I missed the last couple of revisions as well due to family reasons. So I miss meeting everyone, really.
Right. Yeah. So let's hope we can hopefully find a place to attend sometime soon.
And yes, I mean, we... parties hopefully would get started again. I haven't really kept a tab on demoparty.net yet, but there are some things still online. I mean, we have the demo nights in Switzerland, which is not really a party per se, but I think that's going to happen in person.
Actually, I don't know, funnily enough, but I think it's happening this weekend. So by the time we're airing this, it's probably has hopefully already passed, right? So let's see how that turns out. So it should be interesting to see.
Yeah, Große Halle im Kulturzentrum Reitschule, something like that, in Bern.
Yeah, that sounded pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I did take German in school, but I can't really recall it much of it. But that's going to happen, and it's a nice addition. I mean, Demo Night stuff has been really good throughout the years. I haven't been to any one of them, but I've followed them afterwards. And I think that there's going to be Tersac online as well. Or Tersac Light,
Right.
It will also happen this weekend, actually, when we record this. So it will have happened when we broadcast this one.
Right. And I think we're also going to talk to Ferris about Terzak at some point. So let's see what his view on Terzak is. So
yeah,
should be interesting. Maybe we should head on over to that.
Yes.
And invite Ferris and Aki in here.
I'll head off and you guys can take care of Ferris.
Right. See you later.
So our guest this week is Ferris, a five-time Meteoric Award winner, coder and musician from Logicoma, Youth Uprising, and Elix, who is also known for his educational streams and videos. Very excited to have you in the studio. Welcome, Ferris.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you.
I'm a big fan and longtime listener of the podcast, especially since it came back. But I remember also listening to some episodes before the hiatus as well, and quite enjoyed it.
Before we knew what we were doing. The shameful past of the Design Podcast. Don't listen to the earlier episodes. They're very dated. Welcome. So for those who don't know you, you've done a lot of high-end modern rendering stuff and 64K, but you also did a bunch of 8-bit work and 16-bit work and all kinds of work.
Yeah, I'm easily distracted and nerd-sniped. And I think that comes across in the variance of platforms that I've done stuff for. But really, it's all interesting from different perspectives, right? And then in the last sort of few years, I've tried to mostly focus, or I guess maybe 5 years with Logicoma, I tried to really get a little more serious with doing the 64K thing. And I think that was a good choice to try and focus up a bit more. But even then, we've still done some more varied things. So anyway, I think that's a lot of fun.
I thought you saw C64. Maybe we should start with the beginning, because I think you're also still, like, for us, Axel and me, old demo sceners. You're still a quite new demo scener. So when did you join the demo scene, like really briefly, and what was your influence to get in, and how did you start?
Yeah, so I was, as a young preteen, was getting into programming, and especially doing games. And I was I bought this book called Game Programming for Teens, which taught Blitz Basic, which actually has roots on Amiga, but I didn't know that at the time I was doing it.
When was this for people to give stuff? I mean, I don't want to.
This would have been 2000. If I was 11, then I guess this would have been 2002 or 3. I mean, I got into programming because I grew up with game consoles, especially like Super Nintendo and N64 and stuff. And I always wanted to make games. And then I started making games on my PC. Got that book, which was really like, because I tried C++ and Java and they were both too hard for me at the time. But this Blitz Basic thing was perfect. I could load images and play sounds and all this other stuff. And that was awesome. And eventually I actually discovered there was within that community, there was a site called Blitz Coder. And that was quite cool because it was just a showcase of people doing stuff in Blitz Basic. And most of it was games. But I found out that there were these guys doing 3D stuff in there too. And they were really inspired by like Amiga demos from, you know, 10 years prior. And then just kind of recreating the feel that they had for that, but on their PCs. And then through that, I kind of discovered that that was the demo scene, but it was a relatively small sect of the demo scene that I don't think was very popular or in line with what was happening in like the larger demo scene at the time. So like, I remember when I discovered Poet, and it was like a mind-blowing experience after that, but I was part of that scene for a little while. And then I guess what I realized is I was much more interested in like graphics than making games. So it was kind of a good fit. And then that was probably around 2005, I think, where I kind of joined the broader demo scene. Maybe 06. I don't exactly remember.
Started going to European demo parties.
Well, so I didn't start going to European parties until a bit later because I was too young and I obviously couldn't get to Europe. So back in 2006 or so, like the reason I started Youth Uprising is I wanted to almost announce my existence. Like I was really cocky and stuff, and I wanted to just say, I don't know, I wanted to be a part of the scene, and I didn't really know a better way to do that other than to be like, hey, I'm here, look, and then like kind of have a mission behind it, which then was just to like, I guess, lift up young people. But really it was just something I came up with and didn't think too much about. I just kind of wanted to meet friends and be able to work with them, so it was kind of a good way to do that. And then by the time I could actually travel to Europe, the first time was in 2010, and it was Duckers of Outrax invited me to the gathering, and they were able to to set a bunch of stuff up there, which is really cool. And actually, I was able to fund it from prize money from winning Assembly the year prior, which was lucky enough to have people that were actually present at the party that could enter the thing, and that was pretty cool. And Gargai did the music for that, so that was.
But you also have a musical side, like a talent on the music, so you write songs as well. Do you also, what came first? Did you have a musical talent first, or talent for mathematical stuff that you turned into coding?
It's hard to say. Like, I remember doing music when I was also quite young for the games I was making and the demos I was making. So I feel like it all kind of started at the same time. Like, my family is really musical, and my brother was playing drums forever. And so I was always around that. And like in high school, I was in a bunch of bands that were all really bad and just having a lot of fun with that stuff. So I feel like it all just kind of happened at the same time. Like, it's all this preteen, teenage angst sort of came out in this creative burst of stuff and programming and music just all came out of that. So yeah, exactly.
And with Youth Uprising, did you also get in touch with other who were in a similar position like you, who maybe just came into the demo scene, or did you have a similar background?
I think so. Let's see if I can remember some of the roster. I hope I don't forget anybody, because it was shifting a lot. We were pretty flaky. So there was me, and then I think the first person that kind of reached out was Waffle, X-House, the Finnish guy. And we did some stuff together, and Decipher. And both of them were already more established in the scene, or at least they had a network. But they were also quite young. And then who else was it? Ized? I actually don't know how you say that, but the Russian guy.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. And he ended up joining Quiet and doing really good work with them. I think, to be perfectly honest, I think we didn't utilize him nearly as much as we could have or really worked as closely with him. And that's like actually a regret that I have in my quote unquote scene career. But anyway, he was a really nice guy and really, really cool to work with for the brief things that we did. And then there was one more person that came later. Confused was that other guy, by the way. So shout outs to them.
And then basically you took it from there and basically or got in touch with other people as well? Or how did you basically then find your way into the demo scene? Did you go to the party first and then go from there?
Yeah, so it was just, it was all online for me. Like, it was way too far away. I was from Idaho, which is like the northwest of the United States. So I was quite far from any real parties. I think Pilgrimage had just either done their last year or was going to do their last couple of years at that time. And I couldn't do that travel. The first party I went to actually was NVC in 2008. This is a couple of years later. And I was able to find a friend of mine that I went to high school with, had family in California. So we were able to go stay with them, and our parents thought it was safe and stuff. So we were able to go then. Which is, it's kind of I realize obviously in hindsight, it's kind of a special party. It's very corporate, to put a word on it, I guess, because it was like a smaller part of GTC, but it was still really cool. And a lot of really like people that I thought were just God tier in the demo scene came, and it was really cool to meet a lot of those people. And included in that was Gargai and Duckers and Mentor and Bonsai and IQ, and just, it's really easy to name drop, like just pick a name from the hot mid 2000 demo seniors list or whatever you want to call that, and they were there. So it's
right, because we were discussing in some early episodes how difficult it would be for new seniors to step into the demo scene, or if there's any hurdles, or if you felt welcome or not, or if it's like a bit unmotivating to get going into the demo scene. Or how did you experience that step, or making that step and reaching out to those people?
So I think the demo scene is a bit more friendly now than it was then. I think like sharing the early work, I think like people were more brutally honest with their opinions than they are now, which I think has positive and negative effects. I was really insecure, so I really responded negatively to that. But at the same time, I was also very lucky, because I think a lot of the people that I met were really nice. And I obviously found that really motivating, and there was a part of me that just wanted to do better. So I also kind of responded to the negative stuff too. But I would say, like, when I look back at the comments, it's actually much more positive than I remember. That's also kind of a funny experience. Like, the negativity bias is really real. So I remember it being kind of difficult, but at the same time, I remember certain people were really friendly and really helped to kind of at least to me, it really felt like bringing me in and making me feel included early on, especially like Gargai and Gloom and some others. So I think that meant a lot, and that made it really a lot easier to join, but it was still hard to be so remote. And I remember really having difficulties working on prods in Youth Uprising, especially because we were all so distributed that it was really hard to pass code back and forth and stuff.
Right. I think when I first met you, you were also showing me some trackers on the Game Boy Advance or something.
It's probably LSDJ. It's probably on the DMG.
Right. Okay. When you look at those at that time, is that did you get interested more in the old school aspects or the older platforms first, and then made the step to the newer platforms, or what was your way of getting in there?
Yeah. So it was. When I was in this Blitz Basic demo scene, it was all like Amiga styled stuff from 10 years before, but I didn't really know that. I just thought that's what the demo scene was these old Bob's effects and whatever. And they were so easy to do because you did this basic software rendering stuff. Like, it wasn't nearly as hard as it was to do those really impressive things back in the day. And these guys that I was following were just kind of mirroring that. So they were just having fun. And I just thought it was like a super competitive thing anyway, because they also copied a lot of like the style. So anyway, I got into like the PC stuff, but I had this background of at least at a very high level coding these old school effects. And so when I discovered, like, it was definitely like PC first is what I kind of came into it with. But then when I discovered that these older demos or like these Blitz Basic demos were kind of recreating the past, I started looking into the past. And then I thought, oh, wow, Amiga's like a really limited machine, really cool thing. C64 really caught my eye. And then that was about the time Edge of Disgrace came out, which just obviously everyone who there's a very clear before and after Edge of Disgrace C64 demo scene, to put it one way.
Yeah.
And that really like changed things. Then I was like, man, I want to look into that. And I kind of knew how to do some microcontroller stuff just because it was stuff I had laying around. And I was always interested in electronics, but never really looked into it that much. And this was kind of an opportunity. I figured if I got a C64, I could kind of learn like really low level stuff, in an environment where I could be closer to a certain kind of the demo scene that I suddenly started to appreciate a lot. So I think my mind being primed with this aesthetic from where I started, and then having to look into how it's actually done, I think was really interesting. But it was definitely PC first, and then old school stuff second. But I feel like that was early on enough that I've kind of had both in the back of my head for a long time.
Right.
And actually, I always wanted to do Super Nintendo stuff from when I was quite young too. And just, it was way too technical the few times I jumped into it. But then when I found C64, it was a similar CPU that I could kind of read some of the code, and it was a simpler system to get started with. So I think that was also a good kind of pave the way to me doing Super Nintendo stuff later eventually.
What platforms did you code on the old ones?
So back then, I think I only really touched C64 and some Super Nintendo in an emulator. But by now, it's Atari VCS, Super Nintendo, Game Boy, C64. I've done some MSX stuff that hasn't turned into a demo.
It should.
It will eventually, right? And I think there's a couple of these platforms I mentioned. I also have some unreleased stuff that I want to turn into a demo, but it'll be a while. VIC-20, I've tried stuff on. That might be it. There might be another one I'm forgetting, but that might be
it. Well, that's quite a lot, actually. So to see this, will that be, because it's actually quite interesting that from Youth Uprising and then Elex was the demo group, the group that you had with Citrix, I think, that was doing the SNES demos.
Yeah, that was a fun little bit of history too, because Citrix and I met at an American party. We met at App Party in 2010. So we met quite early on, and his stuff was just extremely impressive. The stuff he was doing with Tia at that time, especially the VCS chip, was just crazy. So I always wanted to do something where he was doing music. And then at some point I started working on a tracker because I wanted, like, the common workflow, at least at that time, was you'd write an XM module or something and use a converter to get it onto the SNES. And I didn't like that. I wanted the samples to be converted in the tool so that you can get the BRR, the hardware compression artifacts actually audible and use the delay and things like that the hardware has built in that you wouldn't get if you just use a module. So I wanted to have like a dedicated tracker, and I worked on that for a couple of years in like 2013 and 2014. And then he was really on board with that. And then it was really easy to rope him into actually getting to do music for the demos. Cause my end goal was a demo and I needed to do a tracker to do that. And I think his end goal was do a tracker because the community really wants that. And unfortunately, that latter part never really came to pass because because of me. I just kind of dropped the ball, but luckily I was lucky enough to have Cetrix use his music that was really good for those demos.
You guys fit together well, I think. Same energy enthusiasm
so
and boundary breaking. No, those demos are awesome. I think the Elix stuff is like, I don't want to say my favorite stuff of what you've done, but it's very high up there of just having so much fun and on an old machine, but not really in an old school way. I think really new stuff on the SCNS was really cool to see.
Yeah, cheers. I appreciate that. Especially that first one I did where it was just me, new it was called, I think was really trying to capture that kind of vibe. And it was funny too, because I had this idea of like trying to apply modern tools to old school demos. And I really wanted to have, like with old school demos, you make all these effects in isolation and then you have to link them at the end. And the linking is really hard. You have to take pairs of effects and find ones that not only flow together, but also are compatible with like what memory regions they use. And these are things that you generally have to do manually, and it can be a real pain in the ass. And I hated that. So I wanted to come up with kind of tools that could help me do that. And I wasn't that far into the development when the gathering came up, and I thought, man, what's a way I can make a demo really quickly? And I ended up coming up with this video compression thing that some people got really mad about after. But I thought it worked really well, and it was a really cool way to kind of present content that I thought was really fun. Like, to me, it was this big puzzle of like, how could I do a demo quickly? How can I use the tracker that I just made? How can I use the assembler I just made? Like, what kind of content could I show, and how could I do it? Like, yeah, I think I already said, but really quickly. And I think the funniest part about it being video is that like, there's almost no visible artifacts. There are a couple if you know where to look, and so people didn't know it was video, and then they got really mad when they found out, which again, in hindsight, it's funny, but I was really upset that people were upset at me about it. But
I think it's really unwarranted. Fun. Yeah, you've made a really fun demo, I think. But that shows, that's maybe a really interesting point of it, shows how your approach is to old school developing on an old school platform is like you want that new school kind of vibe of like it's tedious to link, and I want to like have this tool chain that I have now. Why shouldn't I grant myself the tool chain that we have developed over the years on this machine?
Yeah, exactly. Even just pulling in Rocket, for example, and just having that available to do like sync hits instead of actually like manually counting frames or kind of describing that. I mean, I did some of that in a couple demos. We did a Game Boy demo with Youth Uprising, and then later with Logic Coma, we did a C64 demo that I was really proud of because it had code in it from when I was like 17. Even though this was 10 years later, that one, both of those did this like manual frame counting, and the former was because I didn't know better, and that's when I learned I hated that experience, and the latter was because it was 4K and we just kind of had to do it. So it's been kind of fun to do it both ways, but I definitely want to come up with better tooling for that kind of thing.
Yeah, because isn't it the appeal of like modern rendering and modern computers versus old computers? So is it for you also to bring that like modern insights to the old machine and see what it can do? Or
yeah, the old school stuff, I have some nostalgia for the Super Nintendo, and at this point I have nostalgia for C64 as well and like Game Boy and stuff. But I don't ever play C64 games. I have a couple Amigas to watch demos on, but I don't really have the same kind of connection with those machines that I have with the video game machines. But at the same time, just looking at them from like a modern technical challenge, like if you remove the nostalgia, it's still an interesting problem because it's like the hardware just does these very limited things. And if you can kind of look at least it tickles my brain really well to just look at like, what can this do? What can I make this do? And I find that really interesting. And it's kind of the same, like a Raspberry Pi Pico came out recently, I think, or like last year, is also a really interesting example of like, I mean, that's way overpowered compared to a lot of these old machines, but it still has like, when I saw the IO units in that, I'm just like, man, what could I make those do? Like it just, you have this limited thing that can only do certain things and you just want to see what it can do. And I guess like, regardless of whether or not it's old, it's the limits that I think are really exciting.
And are there techniques that you take from modern rendering and from the tools that you now know that you can apply to old school coding that you can bring to those machines?
Yeah. So like the obvious example is doing something like sync tracking, to change effects and writing the schedule. It was actually interesting because Spindle, I think it's called, is LFT's linker for C64, actually embodied a lot of the ideas that I wanted to have in modern development, where like I want to describe a timeline. I don't want to like sit here and do all this linking in manual code. I want to describe a timeline and just have my code like call into some some routine. And even if I have to do with some compiler that like preprocesses everything and moves everything out of the right places on the disk, like I want to do that at a higher level of abstraction. And really, I think that's what you can take from the modern approaches, is just that on a modern demo, you usually just have so many CPU cycles, you can do almost anything you want. So you end up doing things to kind of make the experience better, or in something like a 4K or 64K to describe something with less bytes, but it takes like an enormous amount of compute to realize. And kind of trying to remove as much compute from the actual machine as possible and like maximize that is kind of an interesting challenge. So, I mean, we have these insanely powerful machines. Like, why aren't we doing better emulation techniques, better compilation techniques? Like, build a compiler that's specific to a platform and specific to doing demos on that platform is kind of the approach that I would love to get to and love to attain. And what does that mean? I think is really interesting. But I wouldn't say that like modern rendering applies so much, except that you can take some like tropes in the current style of things and apply them. Like in the 2014 Elix demo, I did a bunch of this RGB, or I actually think I only used it once, but this like red and cyan distortion effects, and I realized you could do that on the hardware because they have hardware additive blending. So you could just put the same image on two layers with each with a different palette, and then you can distort their scroll positions. So like you can kind of pull the visual style from modern stuff, but I think the techniques, it's more of an inspiration rather than something you can apply directly.
Right. Do you think that coming from the old school, people take that approach less? So do you see it happen there as well? Or is it for you coming in like more fresh-faced with a different background?
So when I started looking into this stuff and started wanting to approach things this way, I think a lot of those ideas were pretty novel. But I must say in the last decade or so, I don't think for me they've been very influential, but I think a lot of people have independently had the same ideas. And I'm seeing more and more of these kind of approaches coming up where other people are doing this.
Vibes and old school.
In not just the visuals, but also the tooling. So I think more and more people are kind of embracing more modern approaches as well, which I think is really nice. And it's reflected in the fact that there's better demos coming out more often. That's ultimately what you want, right?
Absolutely. I think that's the most important thing that we want. Absolutely. I think that's what it's all about. Do you think like, are there things about like, because you do both, about like modern rendering that are regularly misunderstood by old school coders, or maybe the other way around? That.
Well, maybe if do you find one thing more challenging than the other? Is there like doing something or getting more out of an old machine is more challenging than trying to keep up with new technologies, what others are doing in the same space?
So the old machines, they take more time. It takes like, I generally consider it is just to have more lead time. If you're going to do anything that's sort of non-trivial on an old school machine, you need to plan it out more. You need to plan, okay, this is how my memory is going to look. This is how, and the way I approach that is I'll prototype it, and where I don't have all the same limits, but I'm kind of have them in mind. Like I make a, for an example of this is I had this full screen zoom plasma in our C64 4K, which I thought I was the first to do, but I found out someone had done it earlier the same year or the year prior. I think it was X.
Oh, wow. It's still like quite late.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it before that, but someone, please prove me wrong if you can, because I don't want to claim something I don't actually have. That I'd started with just the plasma, just in like a high end. I did it in Rust, in software rendering, and then just sat there and massaged it until the data looked like exactly like it would on the C64. So I ended up with this kind of halfway to an emulator kind of setup with that, and then by the time I had to port it to the machine, it was more or less trivial. But then all that stuff took a lot more time than it would have taken to, for example, raymarch some scene. And even if you're going to raymarch quite an impressive scene, I think you can do that in less time than it takes to do a lot of this old school stuff. And that's also just me, because like I don't have 30 years with this stuff. So I think some people can do it a bit faster. But I talked to Jack Asser, for example, which also said that he had the same approach. So at least that's one other example of someone who does it that kind of same way.
He has the same approach that he starts on like new school, let's say new programming language, try an effect out and then slim it down to make it work on the old school effect. So even where you think that the old school people would just still be coding on that C64 and typing the assembly themselves, and no, they're also just...
Some still seem to actually do that, but at least I just think it's too complex to start on the actual hardware and kind of work up. I think it's easier to do it the other way. Like try an idea and see if it's going to look good.
Yeah.
And then start imposing more restrictions. And then if it still looks good, then you can kind of take the effort that's required. Cause it's just hard. but I think the new school stuff, then the difficulty comes in the other direction. Like how I find it more of a, I don't want to say more of a creative challenge, cause I think that's poor wording, but I think, yeah, you can combine and compose more things in so many more ways. Like your space is a lot larger, I think. And searching through that, which you can do quicker, you can iterate a lot more quickly, but your search space is larger. So it's a difficult problem in that sense rather than a technical sense. Although it can be difficult in a technical sense, but it's usually more on the creative end, I think.
Right.
The old school stuff you seem to do alone or with like one person or two people, or and Logicoma is like it's a group, it's a fully formed group. It has four members. So
yeah.
Is that a different like you have that like challenge to share it with people? One of them who is who quit the demo scene when you were born, which I still find very funny that Logicoma yeah. is like a high end group that has one of the like a really old school demo scener in there doing really high end stuff.
Yeah, that's so funny. Like so first of all, to answer that kind of question, like you're totally right that when I'm doing old school stuff, it's usually more of a lone venture. And when I'm doing the high end stuff, it's usually more of a group thing. That comes down to tooling and again, experience is the wrong word, but like the how easy it is to bring people yeah. in. Like I'm not that well connected in the C64 scene. I don't have these old friends for 30 years or whatever. There are a few, like Blueberries to name one is someone who I will probably continue to do old school stuff with. I think he and I have a lot of similar approaches and ideas. But in general, it's like I'm inspired by something. I want to know how something works. And then I reflect that by making my own version of it, right? And that's in the old school stuff that ends up just, I just end up doing that alone.
I'd say go to X 1 year. They will love you. They will adopt you like their own because the C64 scene is starving for new talent and they're all going to be super helpful. That's what we noticed as well when we did our C64 demo there.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah,
they were just super enthusiastic that there was somebody else doing C64 stuff. So absolutely come to X when it's happening.
That's brilliant. I definitely need to go. I did go to Datastorm 1 year and it was also very warm there. So that was really, yeah. really nice, a good experience. But yeah, I definitely need to get
awesome.
To
X. The C64 team is an awesome group of people that are just super welcoming and happy that somebody else is interested. Like, come
yeah.
break the monotony in our demos in a very good way because they're awesome people. I had so many fantastic chats there with all these people that have been doing it for decades.
Yeah, I should say that too, that like, yeah, I'm not friends with them for... because they're all dicks or something. It is that no. is that has been my experience too, is that when I briefly met a lot of these people, they have been really nice. And even yeah. Sometime after Edge of Disgrace came out, I sent an email to HCL just asking like the noobest questions, and he got back to me, and like that meant so much. So like, yeah, those guys are awesome. So when it comes to the new school stuff, it's so much easier to collaborate. And that started with so Wobble and I had done music together. Like we met at the Gathering 1 year, and then we kind of clicked creatively just doing music and like high-end music. So he was a big part of just like a lot of the music I was doing in 2013, 14, 15, because we hung out a lot. And around the same time, I was doing the Wavesaber synth. I think I did most of that work in 2012, but 2013, I did most of the work that would enable it to really sound good. And then Ian Hoffman caught wind of that. And that was really how the group formed. Like after that, Hoffman and I did a couple tracks together, just Exa Music tracks. And then when I was kind of finally ready to start some visual tooling, then it was obvious that those are the guys I was going to go with. And so because we have those tools and we can kind of just communicate by doing the work, if that makes any sense, like we don't,
yeah,
we can kind of talk about what vibe we want or whatever, but it's also just so easy to just be like hop on the Google Drive and just take the song and make a new version and be like, hey, what do you think of this? And it's so fast that the collaboration just naturally more happens. And actually in Logicoma, I think our visual tooling fails completely at that. Like it's again, me doing everything alone. And I want to spend more time fixing that. So hopefully the other guys can get more involved on that side as well, but especially musically, cause we're all of us except Darth Shader, I guess, are musicians. So we,
But yeah, but is that also because you can't let it go that you're like, it ends up on your plate again because you don't open it up to the others? Or is it just that happens because you don't take the time to make it easier to work together?
Yeah. So in, I must say, in Logicomic's case, I think it's mostly that I haven't done the work in the tooling to open it up to the other guys. But I'm not going to deny that there have been instances where, like, I didn't want to open it up due to like lack of trust or putting a lot of like pressure on myself to do like the best demo ever and not trusting other people to help out. And I don't really know where that comes from. And I don't know if I can or want to share specific examples of that, but I'm not immune to that.
I think that's very common, actually. It's like at one point you're creatively so in charge that it feels scary to let it go. I think we've all dealt with that, even me as a musician doing a co-op, and you kind of feel like, but I don't know if I want to share this with you.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with it? Like, I think it's very normal to have that reaction. So yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think I even had that with Ian the first when we did Backscatter. Maybe that's a good example, actually. That I feel comfortable sharing. Like, I remember I had the whole buildup and the drop in the song just like ready. And then I couldn't finish the track and do the visuals. And so he jumped in and helped. And I remember asking him to like, don't touch this, like just build out. And he did, and he did great. But in, I must say, like after some of those experiences had really earned the creative trust, like, yeah. I feel bad saying that because I feel like he shouldn't have had to, but I remember feeling that. And then the later works that we did together was so collaborative. Like, once that barrier was gone, like that's really the point I'm making here, is that was a barrier, yeah, that I had put up due to insecurity or whatever. And as soon as that was gone, all of our stuff got better.
And I think you don't have to apologize. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think that you said like Hoffman will treat that professionally, and of course will respect your wish to leave a certain thing like that because you're collaborating on this, and he's a very professional person in that aspect.
Yeah, I don't think I ever asked that again, because
no, but then you don't have to, because it's something from you. But that makes a lot of sense. I think, yeah, that's everybody that makes something and then shares that can relate.
Yeah, that was like a growing moment for me, that just everything got better once I got over that.
No, because it's awesome. I think, again, like where you come from and then doing like the work you've done in the demo scene and all these different levels, like from old school to new school, working with an old school or new school stuff, and it's awesome to hear like an insight in that way of thinking and that being afraid. Like, it's also good for people to know that it's okay to be a little bit afraid, and it's okay to like sometimes don't like bad feedback. And I think absolutely, as a demo scene, we should be more productive in that. So it's all good.
Yeah, I must say that stuff that has never gone away from me either, like that insecurity and stuff. But this, you learn that like part of this is gonna feel shitty, but the rest is worth it. You know what I mean?
I've been doing this for 30 years, and I get nervous when I'm in a music compo and I probably won't be played because I'm not pre-selected. It will never go away. It's part of the charm, and it's, yeah, also part of the, and you want that kind of acknowledgement of your peers that you did something awesome. And even though we do it for fun and it's a hobby, we all kind of do it. It's a little bit scary, and that was what makes it fun.
Would you say you're losing a part of the artistic control when you need to open up for a larger project that more people are working on?
Yeah, you do lose some of that artistic control, but if you lose it to people who you're able to communicate on some level with, like creatively, I don't necessarily mean with words, but like at least with Hoffman and Wobble and I, like we'll all work on the same song and it's still the same song. Like it gets pulled in a few different directions, but somehow the vision is still there, whether or not we actually communicated it explicitly or not.
Right.
If you have that, it doesn't matter that you gave up control, because there was, the control didn't help you.
Yeah, the control doesn't necessarily make it better, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like the control is just a barrier. So if you find people that you can work like that with, like hang on to them.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you'll go so much farther and do more amazing things together.
The secret of every good demo group that's been together for a long time is that they understand each other and work together really well. And I think that is sometimes like, oh, people, we do stuff alone and demo groups split up and they share. And sometimes it's a shame if it's like, oh, it was so good together. But sometimes also the new influences. Because do you still do solo stuff? Like the old school stuff? Like the Game Boy stuff that you're working on, which I've heard.
Yeah.
And MSX stuff. That's probably not going to be Logicoma, is it? Or is it?
Man, I got a Game Boy EP that I need to get out. I need to finish the songs. I need to get that out. That'll be really fun, I think.
Is that the stuff you played to me like a decade ago?
Yeah, some of that
was awesome.
There.
Like, that's awesome. That was awesome stuff. It should be heard by people. I still have some of that, like LSDJ songs. I played them at a 9 bars once secretly.
That's awesome. That was awesome. I'm actually really happy to hear that.
Yeah, when I was the 5-year anniversary party, I was the last surprise DJ, and I ended the set with your bangers on Game Boy because they were pretty much, it was 2013.
Oh, that's so cool.
And that was that like noisy, dubstabby kind of electro clash, what's it called?
Sour Candy, electro, maybe.
Yeah, might Sour Candy. That was a Complextro style. I think that was the name Skrillex made up, but that was just the baller track to end with. So this is all okay, but fair enough. But to go back to old school a little bit again, like as you do a lot of like programming, like modern programming for a job as well.
Yeah, I've done a lot of different jobs at this point, but all rotating around programming. Currently, I'm a compiler engineer at a company that's making a data center processor.
That's like the programmer's programmer. You make
yeah, like quintessential.
Quintessential program. So is the old school stuff then also something you do to unwind? Like I've heard from the TBL guys that they would work at DICE and then come home and bang on Amiga because it's so different. Is that the same for you?
Yeah, I mean, the whole demo scene is for me. Like I did some professional graphics programming when I was at OutTrax, which became Fuse. And I definitely noticed that when I was doing this stuff professionally, I didn't want to do it as much at home. Yeah. So career-wise, I kind of wormed my way out of that stuff and just sort of doing more technical lower-level things and kind of... It turned out that I sort of started old-school stuff as a way to get better at computer architecture, but I've now ended up making that more my career and then staying creative in the stuff that I do in my free time.
Does that mean it's less old-school stuff then that you do in your free time because it's so much like that... architectural programming?
Well, I mean, when you get sufficiently into computer architecture, you find out the old stuff doesn't really help you anyway. It was just things were the way they were at a certain time, so it's now like sufficiently separated the modern stuff versus the old school stuff that I don't think,
because that's also a thing. I think it's so true that when you do something for a hobby and you make it your job, I always like tell people not to do it because you ruin the thing you love. Like you have to be really strong in liking something to make it your job.
Yeah, I did a EP in 2014 that just turned me off of music for a long time. It was, I loved doing that at the time. I mean, it was really stressful at the end, and the people I was working with the label were really nice. And like, Wobble did a track on there that we collaborated on that was really cool. But I just couldn't make music at the same capacity for a long time, and kind of still feel like I can't. So that was,
That's
I feel
hard.
Like I got burned
like,
by that.
What's it called? Everybody should buy it. What's
it's
it called?
It's called
a Poly. By Ferris or by?
By Ferris. It was on Most Addictive Records, and I think it's still on Beatport, but like the album art's missing and stuff. So I don't even know if you can really find it. But I'm still proud
of
that
go
stuff.
Go support Ferris.
What?
Go support Ferris. Everybody buy Poly. Poly. It's called, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go buy it on Beatport and Juno and wherever it might be, and then support. Cheers. But that's actually somewhat. Sad even to hear. So that's like when you do something as a hobby, so the unwinding goes to different things, different creative outlets.
Yeah, I think I wanted, like at the time it was that I was doing a lot of music and I wanted to like make more out of that time investment. Like I wanted more people to hear my music and stuff, so that's why I tried to do it commercially, because you could get a label promoting it and things like that. And I just found out that like it is a whole other level of work and I just couldn't keep that up. And on top of that, like labels want artists, like they want people that they can promote. Like I'm a guy who just does random creative stuff, if you know what I mean. So maybe the term artist in that sense is probably not correct, but they want marketable artists, right? I think that's a better way to put it. Whereas I'm just like a guy that's inspired by too many things, and I'll put random stuff out. Like maybe I'll do a Game Boy EP soon. Maybe I'll do an old school thing soon or a 64K thing. Who knows? I want that freedom. But they want people who are going to do the social media grind and things like that, which their people will do that. And people are really good at that. And I'm not.
Terrible.
Yeah.
No disrespect to anybody that does it. It's awesome, but it sounds like a lot of work. And I think that you have to be really dedicated to that art.
Yeah, it comes with the job. It comes with the territory.
So to go back to the old school, new school, and artist, yeah, the coding differences.
Do you have a preference? What kind of style you want to do next, for example? I mean, or what kind of thoughts are you making before you decide on, am I going to do something more old schoolish on an old school platform or a new piece on a modern?
Yeah.
Piece?
So the old school stuff usually grows out of like, I'll come up with an idea, like a technical idea. And then it kind of experiment with that and grows out of that. So those are really technically oriented and they usually come from like a random bit of inspiration or oftentimes other old school demos, usually from other platforms. You'll see something on C64 and be like, oh, that could be done with 256 colors and way faster on SNES, for example. And then like you start exploring that. Whereas for like 64K, it comes from the other, like the artistic side. I follow way too many artists on Twitter and I have this huge Vimeo stash that is just, I get so excited when I see some of that stuff. And then I just have to explore those more creative ideas. So it kind of pulls more in that direction. So they're really different sources of inspiration for me and different ways of exploring ideas. So they feel very different. And in terms of whether or not, like, I decide, like, I don't sit there and decide, oh, I want to do a 64 demo. I haven't done that in a while. That usually doesn't happen. It's usually all, I feel like I'm more bombarded by ideas rather than coming up with things to do.
Right. So you need to select the right pieces then.
That's what I feel like. There's all these impulses, and then like the hard part is deciding what to grab, what's worth exploring.
Mm. Where did the reclamation come from?
The reclamation came from Ian, really. Like he knew that he wanted to do one of these tracker things. He knew, so he also agrees that like a lot of the stuff should just be tooled better.
Okay, so I'll do a quick backstory for people that don't know Reclamation.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
You know what we're talking about. So Reclamation is a demo by Logicoma in XMPlay, which is used as the visualizer, the player on revision for the Tracker Music Compo. And the Tracker Music Compo is usually the first compo at revision, is how we kick off the party. Is usually not the most visited compo because people don't really care about Tracker Music. And it got, so basically, but you see the patterns come down, and that's, and Ian had already, Hoffman, we should use nicknames because everybody is.
Yeah,
still
sorry, so we're used to calling him by his name.
Hoffman already had messed with like effects in these visualized in the tracker patterns, and then Reclamation was basically a demo in XMPlay and ruined the whole compo for everybody that just made a song. Well, didn't really, it was just really fun actually. But I remember coming up to you because that's usually where I have an entry in, because that's how I feel safe participating in that. And coming up to you like, fuck you, Ferris, you ruined the only combo I could participate in. But I meant that fuck you in the most wonderful way, you know that.
Right? Usually it is meant that way. I think it was the year before I said a similar to fuck you to Nobi when Absolute Territory came out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, was that the pattern messing and Ian Hoffman?
Yeah, no, Hoffman wanted to do that, and he wanted to do it on a level that he felt hadn't been done before. And because even in that same compo, this was 2018, and even in that same compo, there were a couple other entries that would make some patterns look like they run backwards and a couple other things. So it wasn't a new idea, but he wanted to do it. He wanted to take it to the next level, and he wanted to do tooling for it where we would kind of generate the patterns offline and then incorporate them in the music. And so he and I did a bit of back and forth about how it might work to do the pattern jumps, how we might organize those. But mostly it was him. Like, I feel like I just kind of provided a bit of input and a little insight, and he was really the driver. And so then he did that. He also did the tools. And then I meant to pick those up and do some visuals and never got around to it, to be honest. And then at the party, we kind of came together and finally did it. And luckily it worked out.
I think it also immediately ended that, like, you also, I think, stopped the pattern muckery in Music Compose somewhat.
I haven't seen it as much since.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think it's also fine. I think it was also like, this is what you can do. And then we kind of, because it got kind of like Hoffman started doing it. People started copying Hoffman. I remember a tracker music competition where me and Gargai were going, oh, this is probably Hoffman, because they don't show the names.
Right.
And then there were four songs we said, this is probably Hoffman.
Yeah.
And then a track came and it was a professional tracker. So, oh no, this is Hoffman. So that was kind of right. Like, it was running its course. And I think you sufficiently ended that there as well with Reclamation. So
it was funny too, because they, like, for several years, because we obviously targeted it for revision and for that platform, and like a question that you suddenly have to ask, which you normally don't have to ask, at least not for the same reason. Like, I guess you always do have to ask, how many channels do I need? But you don't usually ask that in light of the fact that you want to do a visualization. So the question we asked was, how many channels is full screen? And he looked up the old compos and realized that it was all the default XMPlay settings. So we knew the projector resolution and we knew how many columns would fit that. And then we get to the party, and that was one of the first years where someone had made a decision running the compo to use a bigger font. And that obviously didn't work for us. So there was a last minute thing where it just didn't make any sense. And so we had to go talk to the orgas, like, oh, okay, we totally get your decision, but please make an exception for us. And luckily they did.
That is
hilarious.
fantastically esoteric reason to at least use Xenplay with the old font, because yeah, we really need it.
Yeah, so we were lucky enough to be able to get special treatment for the settings of Xenplay for that.
I feel you won fairly, because the song was actually good as well.
Yeah, it wouldn't have worked if the song
I was kind of miffed of, like, it's a gimmick.
Yeah,
that would, but the song was great, so it, fair enough. But I already saw the track of Music Compo being ruined by people just doing demos in it now. And I'm happy that didn't happen. I'm happy it's still that first compo that we all sit, all 19 of us trackers sitting in front being super excited about it.
Yeah, I still, that's, of all the recordings of productions that we've done, that one has my favorite crowd reaction. So I watch that periodically. That's really fun. And I think
that's the most friendly fuck you that you will ever, because that was so much like, oh, God damn it, Logic Compo. When it came on the screen at last light, we're like, oh.
Yeah, that
we're
was super
fucking
fun.
Do it,
and yeah, we did fill. It was like a 2 meg limit, I think it was, and we did fill it. And we had to cut back some of the patterns in the visuals to make room for the music, just so you know that we made the right trade off.
But going back to the old school, new school demo scene, we were supposed to talk to that, like the difference of like coding these two things as you're versed in both. We go off on your history in the demo scene, but I think it's very tight knit together, because as you say, like you do a lot, like whatever piques your interest is something you jump into.
Yeah, I can't help it. It's a curse.
I know that feeling in music. I jump so many unfinished songs that I will never finish because is that fine?
Do you have anything on your bucket list that you say, okay, I just want to do that once?
Elix has to do a third one at some point.
Yes.
That has to happen. What other bucket list things? Honestly, one of the bucket list things that I used to have was I wanted to make a really good intro packer, and Squishy became that. So that was one that I kind of feel like I've achieved.
I like that you're also so much on the tool side. Again, I think that's a bit of the new school mindset of that you're really thinking about processes and tooling and the software you need to make. Like, you already called it Rocket. Just to quickly explain, Rocket is this sync tool that I think Scrabble made.
Scrabble and Kuzma.
And then Kuzma made it like shareable, and Scrabble made it because he was a musician,
right,
and he wanted to sync the way he made music. So he basically made a tracker to sync demos. That's basically what it is, right?
Okay, so if Scrabble started it and Kuzma kind of took it over the finish line, that's a bit of history that I don't know. So apologies.
I think they helped each other. Like, I think Scrabble started it with the, like, I am a musician, I have a musician's mind, and then Kuzma was really intrigued. Maybe Kuzma, you could correct me on Twitter. Please at me.
I'm sure
people do. It's awesome to hear that. Like, from previous podcasts, people at me saying I was wrong. But that's the thing, because I love that it was the musician mind, and I only understand trackers, so I want a tracker to sync my demos.
Yeah,
it's a fantastically awesome concept.
Yeah, and it's turned out to be, I think, really popular because it's so easy to integrate, and it's good enough for most things. And I think we have used it, all of the demos in Logic Coma. I used it for new. I didn't use it for Smash It, that other Elix demo, because then I tried to build this. I wanted to use Ableton Live. I wanted to use the Curve Editor in Live. And so I had this setup that was based in Max for Live that would send MIDI to this little server that was running the demo. So I had this little preview that was emulator based, and I could send commands from via MIDI from Live. And then at the end, when we packed up the demo, I would parse the Ableton project and pull out the curves, because I already had that tech from Wavesaver. So yeah, that kind of worked, except the MIDI events could go out of order. So I had a bunch of these issues where, like, I could have a track that said, how much is this effect loaded? And then I would just make sure that the DMA was set up such that that would line up, I guess. And then, but in the tracker, like, it would go between effects. And then those last messages where it was like the 90% loaded and the 100% loaded would come out of order. So in the tracker, it would be like broken in the preview a lot of the time, and that was really annoying. So I think that's fixable. I think you can just do some protocol that doesn't actually send messages out of order and things like that. But that actually turned out to be a pain in the ass, so I didn't approach that again. But yeah, so we've experimented with a couple different things, and then I think I just need to bite the bullet and do a proper one. And I've been saying that for years, and I just find other fun things to look at.
I like what I hear in your approach is that you seem, instead of like having the approach of like I'll be on the machine and the machine kind of dictates, you have an idea of I want to do it like this thing I know.
Yeah.
I'm going to make that happen.
I think that's a really good way to put it. Like the machine has its limits, but there's a lot of like artificial limits. that people just suddenly impose. Like, I remember seeing, I think it was on the demo scene Discord, someone, like, it hadn't occurred to someone that they didn't have to do, they didn't have to use an assembler to write some of their code or something. I don't remember the exact case, but it was one of those things, like, you don't,
because you hear that and that's what people do, so you probably have to do it like this.
Yeah,
and that's the difference in old school, new school a little bit, or maybe just old school, new school versus Ferris, is that you just approach it like, I want to be able to do this thing.
Yeah, the hardware does what it does, and however you get it to do that, that's up to you. So if you're doing assembler or macro assembler or C, or if you're doing something completely different, as long as it gets the hardware to do what you want it to do, then it's a valid approach, and it might be a better approach depending on what you want to do.
Yeah.
So it's just that whole mindset.
That maybe that also kind of like, you have to do it the right way, else you won't be respected. If you like, if, for example, that Elix demo that was video, and people were kind of like, oh, it's compressed video, so now it's lame.
Yeah.
Where the visuals are for you, it's like, no, I made these visuals happen in my toolchain, and you literally like, I don't get it why you would hate on this. Where the old school demo scenes go, you have to do it in real time.
Yeah.
We've talked about this before.
At the time, that's how I felt. Like, why don't people? I mean, if you don't find something interesting, you know, to each their own. But I remember being confused at that. Like, man, I did a video codec. I did the visuals. I did everything. Yeah, like, what's wrong with this?
what's wrong with this? And I voiced this exactly the same. I'm exactly the same. It's like, I'd be enthusiastic that people do things on computers, but there is this mindset. And it's nothing. Again, also understand where that comes from, is that whole real time and making the machine do the work, and it's cheating.
Yeah.
So, I'm doing air quotes when I say cheating. You can't see that, but... Because if you do something else, where I always think the result is what matters, and everybody was faking everything in the 90s and 80s as well.
Yeah.
And just not telling everybody. I mean...
I think there's a good way to look at it, having reflected on that a bit more, which is just that, like, where they're coming from is they see, oh, the machine's not being utilized, and that's lame, right? And that can be a fair perspective. I would argue that most polyfillers also don't use the machine very well, right? Because a lot of them leave the tricks in the video hardware like just untouched. And so I think that most of the people that say that don't really have a leg to stand on. However, I kind of agree with the point. And something like Nu doesn't use the hardware as well as it could. Because I've even thought later, like, what if I did the best video codec for Super Nintendo rather than just what I could do quickly? And I think I could make a much better one. I think like the Titan guys have done that with some of their prods as well. They did really good video codecs and some of their stuff. So I think there's a lot of room to grow there. And so from that perspective, I get it, right?
But I think that's a very good take, that old school coder like has a different mindset than, yeah. How would you convince somebody, an old school demo maker, to do a modern demo or to use modern techniques or...
I don't know. I don't know if I would want to convince them, because I feel like if they're doing, it comes from a different place. If they're doing what they're doing because they've always done it and they loved it, then I'm doing them a disservice, right?
Yeah, that's fair, actually.
But if someone wants to approach those and wants to try some other approaches, and they really sit down and just think about what they want the machine to do, like literally what's the best way to achieve that? And also like, what do you want to do creatively? Like, if I want to have synchronized screen flashes was actually a big motivator for doing a custom sync thing for Super Nintendo. It was just like, I didn't want to count frames and match those with my tracker drums or whatever. I wanted to, at the very least, parse my tracker file beforehand and store some kind of optimized format so the machine does very little work, right? Because it's like an approach like that uses fewer CPU cycles, but it uses more ROM. But that's the trade-off. It's not, is this cheap or not? It's, what are the implications of the technical decisions I'm making? If I have a lot of ROM, it's not cheap to use a lot of ROM. And the Super Nintendo is a particular system where that makes a lot of sense. A lot of the cartridge consoles have relatively large ROM that's just almost immediately accessible. Like, you have insanely high bandwidth versus something like loading from a disk. And so that's one of the reasons why a demo like Overdrive or like the Elix stuff has faster pacing than a lot of C64 demos. So you have higher bandwidth from the disk, or higher bandwidth than a disk.
Yeah.
And so, like, what are you doing with that? Like,
yeah, and it's not cheating if you use that to the advantage.
Yeah.
Even to store video, because you actually use the machine at its best.
Right. And I would argue that for example, Nu didn't do that in the most satisfying way. I would agree with that. But my point still stands. Like, you have, what are you doing with all that ROM? if you're not using that, you're wasting an opportunity. What are you doing with all the CPUs? It's the same way as what are you doing with all the CPU cycles? If you're not using that, you're wasting an opportunity. So if you're not, you could almost argue if you're not maxing out all your HDMA channels, all like everything that the machine can do every cycle, there's more to do. And I think some people can get really excited about that. And that's,
yeah,
that's fun.
I love that. I think that's such a good, what a nice way of putting it. And I absolutely agree that making the machine do the cool stuff is what it's about. And
right. That's I guess to sum it up, that's what bugs me is like, it's conflated. There's an idea of not pushing the machine enough is conflated with the idea of doing things like polyfillers, which is, you know what I mean? Because like polyfillers can be really cool, but most of the time, that I just think that's a bad example. And it seems that there's a particular overlap of people that are really interested in things that people used to think was really hard and aren't necessarily looking at like, what can we actually do? Like I guess that's the question that I would want people to ask more is like, where can we go next? And I think Eon was just such a good example of answering that question. In terms of they really took this artistic vision that they had and really made it happen. And they did all the technical stuff. They did all the disc loading. They did pre-calc and mixed some parts of the music, but not others, right? Because again, it's trade-offs. You don't have to pre-calc the whole music. You can pre-calc a small part with like a filter section or something and play that when you don't need the rest of the disc bandwidth, stuff like that. I don't actually remember if that's something that they did, but you should be operating on that level.
But you know, but that's what I appreciate. That is, I love Eon because it did show that we had this idea we want to put in this machine.
Yeah, and they did it so well. They did it just miles ahead of anything else. Like you can show that to. There's this list. I think it's by Nobi and Muzu. Is that the poet names? Which is old school demos for people who don't like old school demos.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a great list, that. And that's like the quintessential one.
Yeah, I use Eon a lot to show to people that like this is basically on a machine that's actually, because the Amiga 1200 has configurations that look like a modern day Pentium computer.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Where the 500 is a piece of crap.
Yeah.
And you can explain it to people like this actually can do very little. And this is how they do that is magic. Like it's, they really make the machine dance and it shows a really cool thing as well.
Yeah.
And I don't want to undermine because I've seen fantastic stuff happen on OCS, ECS the last few years. It's absolutely been a new platform that people have been
definitely
breathing new air into. And you should do that.
Oh, I have a lot of pressure to do that. And it's going to happen someday, surely.
I think we hear this from a lot of people we've had on the show is that it's so rewarding. It's like having that result to show then to your friends or having that thing done.
Yeah.
So incredibly satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of that too, like where... I feel like I throw myself into things to kind of as like a self-improvement, but there's definitely an aspect of like, man, I'm so excited for Blueberry to see this. I'm so excited for, you know what I mean? So it's definitely both sides. It wouldn't exist without the community, even though I feel like it's a very personal exploration. It wouldn't be fun without the back and forth.
The community elevates it. The community elevates it by also... honestly commenting, and that's what you said about like people sometimes being brutally honest in the comments going like, this would be better, but and there's always things to improve, but I think overall when you talk to people it's always super helpful and super positive and like, you made something, but how can you make it better? Sometimes people want to hear, oh, you made something awesome, here's a cookie, but you actually want to hear, how can you improve yourself and make better stuff?
Definitely.
I think that sometimes it's hard, but it's so rewarding in the end, and getting tips on like, yeah, sorry, but your snare sucks.
Yeah.
Next time, really don't use that sample anymore.
Yeah.
Like for me, I really can't do that much coding or anything else. So for me, it's always the music, and it terrifies me. That's why I'm always nervous. I mean, that's.
It's the same thing though. Like people will be, you'll do something and people be like, oh, that scene flickered and it ruined it for me. And I've been that person too. So it applies generally.
Never stop doing. I think it's good to like always do it and always receive it. We always want everybody to be better.
Yeah.
And even when we don't like stuff that people make.
It's easy to assume bad faith, but it usually isn't coming from that place.
It's also for preferences as well. I got some comments on our previous episode about nostalgia and people were like, oh, that I didn't like stuff that was nostalgia. And it's like, it's okay. Like you make stuff you like and people love it and it's fine. And not everybody has to love the same thing. And I'm just happy people make the stuff they love.
Definitely.
Be excited.
I kind of want to circle back briefly, actually, to something we talked about earlier, because you also asked about like the tooling. And actually, the motivation for that also comes from like, if you just kind of sit down and it's a similar thing, if you reflect on like, what could I do with this machine? So for example, the Packer that I worked on, Squishy, was the same kind of thing. Like, I knew I wanted to do a Packer, but then I guess that's kind of what led me to the mindset. But the mindset was like, where is there room to improve a Packer, right? And like, where is, like, if you look at 64K, for example, like the Crunchy was the one that was, and still is very good, right? And has been, it's actually extremely well balanced in terms of compression ratio versus the resources it uses to achieve that. But I was like, well, we have way faster CPUs and more memory. So like, what can we do with that? Is that an interesting thing to look into? And it turns out that was a good intuition, but that's also kind of a basic question. And I feel like a lot of people, there's a lot of things that they take for granted. Especially from people, I guess newer people, especially it's harder not to, right? But like, if you've only ever seen prods on Shader Toy and done with Crinkler, then you assume, oh, that's the way it is. It's not going to get any better, but usually it can. And I think that's kind of interesting to be able to, like, you're able to peel back that layer if you want to.
If you ask, people don't ask the question, because we have Crunchy and it's fine. It still does the job. So why would we improve it?
Crunchy is still very good. But if you have...
This is what we have.
Yeah, if you have a... If you don't mind waiting a couple of seconds like you didn't used to. used to mind. And if you still don't mind, I can get you a better ratio most of the time.
Was that the same incentive that made that started WaveSaber? Or was that just you, like, since they're cool and we had 64 Clang and I think all these were there? And
I think WaveSaber technically started after 64 Clang, just to be pedantic about it. But I knew I wanted to do a 64K synth for a very long time before I did it. I think 2008, I started one that didn't go anywhere, and I started another one in 2011, and I started WaveSaber in 2012. And then that's the one that worked. So just trying different ideas and different approaches to how I wanted the tooling to work. And it really was actually, I think, working with Gargai's MVX synth that gave me the idea for the tooling. And he has his organized such that it's made up of a bunch of separate buzz machines. Buzz is also, I think, tracker with roots in the demo scene. But it was something I never connected with, except that I used it to write some songs with Gargai's synth. And I didn't like it. I wanted to use a lot of the tools I was already using. And just that combination and the fact that I wanted to make a synth was enough impetus to actually start doing it. So I took his workflow approach, but instead of buzz machines and buzz, I did VSTs in Reaper at the time. And then later transitioned to Live, and that was it.
I think it's that common theme again of where you're like, I didn't want to work like this because I have my own way of working. So I'm going to adapt that to my own synth.
I think there's something really satisfying about like using your own tools. And it's really fun when you can identify enough of a reason to do it. So you don't just feel like you're wasting your time, I guess.
But that was an awesome insight to actually get that from this talk. Is like the way you approach that is really cool. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, and thanks, Gargai, for having that idea before. And I just applied it to
no, it doesn't work. And again, working on other people. Yeah, absolutely. And I think NVScene, because NVScene was controversial when it happened as well. But if it brought like Ferris more into the demo scene, I'm happy it happened.
I'm pretty happy it happened, I must admit.
Yeah, way more other reasons I'm happy it happened. But there was a time when it wasn't a demo scene, that late 2000s, there was a pretty controversial time when things were quite changing quite heavily.
Yeah.
See where we are now, it's like, it's fun to see. It actually was, that was a fantastic thing that happened.
Yeah, and I'm so glad like people brought amazing prods there too, because I think, like most demo parties you go to and it's more of a family gathering kind of vibe, right? Which is awesome. Like I love Solskjaergården or Tursak are some of my favorite parties that I always go to. And well, not Solskjaergården anymore, unfortunately, but I guess, was it called Somewhere in Norway that's coming up now, which I think is going to be really cool.
Yeah, that's people getting old and organizing new parties coming. But there was always this like that the demo scene was very non-commercial, which was also not really true, because in the 90s, Gravis sponsored like the heck out of the demo scene.
That's and awesome.
It was like, but it's that.
I wish they still did. It's so hard to get a Gus.
Yeah, what was his name again? John Smith, I think, from Gravis, was handing out Gusses to everybody. Like, they were like candy. It was bizarre.
That's painful.
In the right time
now.
At the demo party, in the right time, in the right place, you got a Gus. Like,
that's so hard to hear right now. Have you been on eBay looking for a Gus? I mean, I'm sure you have.
Oh,
one,
but... I know. Jesus. I know how Shifter has been holding his Gus collection tight. He's like, the people giving it to him because, what are we doing with this old guy? How so many Gusses ended up on the bin? But yeah, that's different. But yeah, I think that whole, that's been always been the mixed like anti-commercialism keeping demo parties going, the whole vibe within the demo scene, and how to get... That's a story for another time, I think. We're going to talk about that again.
I actually want to talk about that a little, because like when I came to Envy Scene, that was like exactly what I expected in terms of like that sort of commercial vibe, because like a lot of cons, I guess you call them now, but like conferences in the US are like that too. And so it just kind of fit. And it wasn't until I started going to actual European parties that I realized like, oh, this, there's like this homegrown punk kind of vibe. Like it always felt punk online, but then I thought it was sort of more professional in a way. And then I learned it wasn't, and I loved it more. You know what I mean?
Yes. Your first experience at like drunk Finns smatted around boozily, yeah. Or like,
but it's like, man, this is the stuff. This is where it's at. And so it's kind of funny that like I feel like it might have even been the fact that I'm like an American is what colored that perception of it.
Maybe,
but I'm so glad that it wasn't that. Like, I feel like I joined something that's way, way cooler than what I thought it was.
I think that's still, yeah, we still have that. There's still this layer of like DIY, like Underground Conference absolutely embodies that of like, we do what we want and we do it the punk way.
And even the bigger parties are like that. You just have to go there and see it.
Yeah, and have to pipe. And then even like from the smallest parties, as you went to Solskogen, and I think like Outline is similar and the Sock is similar, where it's just a bunch of guys running a party in a shed. It's just a really good time. Awesome, like, and that's, yeah.
I'm so excited for the last Terzak. Like, I'm so sad it's going to be the last one, but I'm so excited for it.
And because people are getting old and having children, and then we can't organize because Terzak is the party where we all get like stinko like teenagers.
Yeah, they call it controlled escalation. It just feels like chaos in a beautiful way.
It started in like the locker room of a squash club in Aarhus. Like, it's always these bizarre locations that people could get for the weekend.
Yeah, I love it.
Wasn't used. but I think we should like get to the end. So is there anything else, Faris, you want to give to the people that listen to the Zine podcast?
Do you have anything particularly you're working on that we might see next?
There's a few things. Actually, the kind of biggest project I've been working on for a couple years is I wanted to make this like game console on FPGA, which I've now just owned it. And now I'm calling it a demo console. I want to make one demo on this one console that I'm making on FPGA. And I'm doing everything from scratch. I'm doing the CPUs. I'm doing the bus designs. I'm doing everything in the GPU. And it's taking ages. I think it's been 3.5 years that I've been working on it so far. So when that demo comes out, I'm going to be really proud of it. And after that, I'm not sure. So we'll see.
That's the
one thing that I feel like I can concretely say that like that will happen eventually.
Right. Excellent. Looking forward to that.
Then we'll make it a scene. Then we have to make it a scene. Honor of Paris.
I think it's
retired after that demo.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a love letter to the demo scene that I entered into and fell in love with. Like, I kind of entered the scene in like the mid 2000s, but I had really shitty computers at the time. So I was watching demos from 5-10 years prior in this like late 90s, early 2000s vibe that I also was immersed in from video games in that era. It's like my love letter to that. And I hope I can make it what I want it to be. So we'll see. But that I definitely will finish that.
What a lovely note to end on. So we'll be looking forward for that. And it might take very long. Hopefully you stick around for a long time and don't see that as your swan song.
Yeah, I don't think I will. There's too many other things I want to do. But that's the one thing I feel happy to share.
That's like Ferris, like an excited golden retriever. New thing.
I'm not denying that.
All the things.
I'm not denying that.
I found a new Vimeo video that I want to work on.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything, and there's going to be so much more new stuff happening, so who knows. So yeah, thank you. It was awesome to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, that wraps up the interview, so thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, so that was the interview with Faris. That was really interesting. I don't know about you, Sifuet. What's your view between or on like the old school versus new school world? Are you attracted by both worlds, or how do you see this?
Yeah, I must say that I am. I really, really love the old school stuff, but I also really, really enjoy the new school stuff. So, and the most exciting bit with Faris when he tells everything like that, he's really, really invested in both. In various aspects as well, because he really loves the itty gritty low end stuff that you need to do for old school things, and then he's quite tough when it comes to the new school things as well. He's an avid Rust programmer, for instance, and I just I like the fact that you can you don't have to choose one side of this. That's the right. That's the beauty of the demo scene, really.
Right, and you also, I mean, you come from the old days and you wrote music on old platforms, and you're writing or should write some more on new platforms. How do you see the challenges from, like, were you interested also by the challenges of the old platforms in that area, or are you overwhelmed by the not having too many limitations on the new ones writing music there? Or
I think that's the biggest problem I have with new school platforms, to be honest, because all of the possibilities. I need to learn. We've been over this before in the podcast. I need to learn to limit myself. Otherwise, I won't get anything done, really, because yeah, I have the world of possibilities where to start. And it felt a bit like Ferris felt the same way occasionally, but found his path through this out. And that's I think that's the toughest bit, to be honest, because if you have limitations, then you know you can't really do much about that unless you bend the rules, like many people do, of course. But you still have a sort of a an easy way into this, and some stuff is getting laid upon you. It's almost I could use someone saying that, okay, you should use only this soft synth in this way. That's it. And then I could get along. And that's what I'm trying to do, to be honest.
Right. So it's the limitations of old platforms also have some comfort for us to know your way through how to work on those old platforms. So yeah. Limitations can be an advantage sometimes as well, right?
Yeah, really creative. Because then you want to, I mean, when you bump your head into a limitation there where it's like, oh no, you can't do this with this limit, then you'll find your way how to solve it in a more intriguing way as well. So it can, of course, be very, lots of experimentation is needed, and that's the fun part of it. Then again, I'm not saying that it's boring to sit with new platforms. It's because then, as you say, sky's the limit. So it's a tough call.
Yep. So yeah, that was very interesting. So
yeah. And I think that we're going to round things up now, because this has been a quite massive episode with a big interview with lots of hopefully good insights for all you who have listened to this as well. And I mean, you did meet, you have met Ferris a couple of occasions in person as well?
At Evoke at some point, yeah. Actually, that's like about some 10 years ago or so. But yeah, that was when he was playing with tracked music on a Game Boy or whatever platform. It was some other platform. But yeah, it was just, and Ultras, it was there as well. And we were just talking, the three of us. It was very, and I was like, this young guy is so talented in these areas. And when Ultrasuit and Ferris were talking on this level, I was like, just, okay, I'm, with my Amiga mods, I was just already surprised that Ferris knew the mods. So that was good fun. That was actually a really strange surprise to see younger people knowing the songs that you made, like, I don't know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago back then on an Amiga. So that was really a wow effect for me personally. So
yeah, I get that feeling quite a lot when talking to other people. I mean, well, I'm talking to you as well. You remember my old mods as well. It's like, oh, this is cool. And I do know your old stuff as well, Axel. So I was really flabbergasted with some of them. It was like, oh, this is really cool when I heard some of your old stuff as well. We have some stuff on Sceneset as well from your old mods.
Okay, yeah, let's skip that topic.
Now it's
move on.
But with this, let's round this off. And this show has been hosted by Aki, Axel, and me, Ziphoid, and was produced, mixed, and edited by Gloom and Gargai, who are currently conducting a worldwide search for the point of all this, really. Special thanks to Scene.org, Scenesat, and Bitfellas. And you can definitely send your questions and feedback to signradioshow@scene.org or contact us on our Sign Radio Show Discord. If you like the show, please share it with your friends and give us a positive rating as well. You can find the Sign Radio Show on Scenesat as well as on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're everywhere. And, well, until the next time, I'm Ziphoid signing off.
I'm Axel. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Okej, då ska jag göra rätt den här gången, tror jag.